Today's reading is taken from Ephesians, chapter 5, verses 3 to 14, and can be found on page 1177 of the Church Bibles. That's page 1177. But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you, as is proper among saints. Let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place. But instead, let there be thanksgiving. For you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure or who is covetous, that is, an idolater, has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not associate with them. For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. And try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. For anything that becomes visible is light. Therefore it says, "Awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you."
Sarah, thank you for reading so clearly. Keep the passage open, please, as we carry on in Ephesians. You'll remember that Paul is writing this letter to a group of Christians in Ephesus. And this section of the letter is written. He wants them to be under no doubt that there is a correct way for Christians to live out their faith. In short, today's passage is all about proper behavior. And I say proper because it is the word that's in the passage. I don't know if you noticed it there in verse 3 in the second half. As is proper among saints. Greek word is propo. See where we get it from? Proper. So very simply, if you're a Christian, then there is a proper way to live out your faith, what you believe. And to make this point really clear, runs all through the passage, Paul contrasts what is propo for Christians with what is not, what is improper. Of course, tradition and etiquette and proper behavior, they're very much part of our world. We're quite used to that sort of idea and language, from the letters we write to the way we shake hands, the way we introduce ourselves, introduce others. I was quite surprised, though, however, to come across a correct code of practice for using chopsticks. I don't know if you've ever come across this. Did you know that you should never hold one chopstick in each hand? About the only thing worse than doing that is to stab the food with a chopstick. And that was particularly disappointing news to me. I find that a very effective technique, especially that elusive little bit of sweet and sour. Debrett's, of course, is the master source on all these sorts of things, proper etiquette in social settings, packed full of useful information like what you do when you meet the Queen. Very important, you know, that when you first meet the Queen, you are to address her as Your Majesty. Each subsequent time you speak to her as ma'am, to rhyme with Pam, even though you're not American. But of course, you see, you can make a fool of yourself with chopsticks. You can blunder while you're speaking to the Queen. It'd hardly be the end of the world. Behaviour becomes a little more important when other people are affected. Consider the damage that can be done when someone in a prominent position abuses the privilege that they've been given for personal gain. We've seen lots of examples of this over the last few weeks. Consider the David Petraeus scandal. He's the four-star general that we've been reading about. He led the US forces in Afghanistan. More recently, left the military to head up the CIA. His resignation was demanded when an extramarital affair was recently admitted. And people argued that a man who couldn't be trusted in his private life should hardly be trusted in the important public role of national security. Improper behavior. We saw it also, didn't we, just this last week from the former Labour MP, Margaret Moran, who she was convicted this week, apparently one of the worst cases of fraud to emerge in the parliamentary expenses scandal. It just isn't right when public servants abuse the privileged position that they've been given for personal gain. Improper behaviour. And these sorts of headlines, they leave a bad taste in our mouth. How can someone who is trusted with so much behave so irresponsibly? Probably fair, though, to say that the bad taste turns to anger, perhaps even to despair. In some cases, you've only got to consider the increasingly offensive revelations of Jimmy Savile's former life to see just how destructive improper behaviour can actually be. Behaviour really matters. That's the point for us to get our heads around this afternoon. And if it matters to us in our world, with all our inadequacies, compromises, how much more to God? Behaviour, proper behaviour, it really matters. In the first half of the book, we saw that God saved us, made us his entirely by his work. His gift of Jesus, grace. It's been the theme of the whole meeting, the reason we chose grace. We need to keep that in mind as we consider issues of behavior. We contribute nothing to our salvation. God does everything. And this fact means everything to us Christians. We live by grace. And so our behavior flows from what God has done for us. And the way God has decided to show the world, to make his glory and his grace known to the world, is through the church, through us Christians. You remember Ephesians, book of two halves, we saw the big transition, 4 verse 1. Live a life worthy of your calling to Christ. You see, God's glory is put on show in us, in the church. And if God's glory is displayed in us, his people, but you can see, I mean, behavior really matters. I mean, just think for a moment. We're hardly going to display God's glory. We're hardly going to show God's grace to the world if we just look the same as the world. We're hardly going to display God's glory and grace if we just act a little bit differently, if we keep making compromises, if we're just lukewarm. You see, the Christian life is not about just being a little bit better than the world. It's not about saying, I believe in grace and holding the door open for someone. It's about being radically countercultural. Proper Christian living. That's what we're going to spend most of our time today. Proper Christian living. You'll see that's the first point. Have a look back at verse 3. But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you, as is proper among saints. Let there be no filthiness nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead, let there be thanksgiving. It's where we're going to spend most of our time this afternoon. You see, to highlight what is proper, Paul lists some activities which are improper, which are out of place in the Christian's life. This phrase, sexual immorality, in the original language, is just the word porneia. It's used in the Bible quite a few times. It's a relatively common word. For example, in Corinthians, the word refers to the practice of incest or sexual relations with a prostitute. In Thessalonians, it means to be sexually promiscuous. More generally, in John's Gospel, the porneia word is used to refer to sexual relations outside marriage. And Paul couples this word with the next word in the list in verse 3, all impurity. Also a very strong word, covering all sorts of different sin. Probably, though, the emphasis on sexual sin again. It's probably why they're coupled together like that. Which begs the question, doesn't it? Why this sudden emphasis on sexual sin at this point? Well, there can be no doubt in the Ephesian culture that there would have been lots of evidence of sexual immorality. We don't know exactly what was going on in Ephesus, but we can certainly get a pretty good picture from other parts of the Bible. We've looked at some of them as we've gone through this. And certainly from sort of archaeological evidence and other ancient documents. Ephesus is portrayed consistently as one of the most pagan and hedonistic cities in the empire. There were at least 15 different temples to different gods and goddesses. Many of them had cultic prostitution sort of rituals attached to them. And sexual activity, especially homosexuality, amongst the whole population was considered perfectly normal, encouraged. According to one source I was reading, right at the heart of the city, almost the sort of centerpiece of this city, there, where the two main roads intersected, there was a big brothel. And outside, written in stone, above the brothel's door, was an advert which simply stated to accommodate every sexual desire for men and women. I imagine the Ephesian culture prided liberal, progressive thinking. And it's so Paul writes into this particular context, proper behavior, Christians. It would have been distinct and noticeable, wouldn't it, to be set apart like that. But I think the reason that sexual sin is highlighted at this point goes deeper still. You see, sexual sin ultimately highlights a commitment to serve not God and his people, but self. Sexual immorality and every kind of impurity flow from a mindset that is first and foremost committed to me, my wants, my desires. The fact that God has made it very clear that sex a good gift from him has a right place, heterosexual marriage. Well, that's completely irrelevant in our world. Which is why the third word in that list in verse 3 is included. Covetousness is vital for understanding all this. It sort of shows the source, the inner spring, if you like, from which all this impurity, this desire to serve self comes. To covet is to desire something that somebody else has. In this context of sort of sexual language, what do they desire? Their body. Their body, my pleasure. And the advice that Paul writes to the Ephesians is, of course, just as poignant for us today. You see, we may think our city is much cleaner and more sophisticated than Ephesus. The brothels may be in the back streets of London. But our culture's commitment to serving self, our own passions, our own desires, remains as prominent as ever. Of course, there are legal skirmishes. Again, we read about them in the papers all the time, don't we? Whether the lap dancing club is given the license or not, whether marriage should include sort of recognizing homosexual couples or not, what should be taught in our schools about sex education. There are legal skirmishes all the time, but it doesn't change the underlying state of our city, of our world. In our natural state, without God, we all have a deep commitment to serving ourselves. And from that commitment flows, or we manage to justify, whatever sexual urges we have. And Paul's saying that that's not the person you are anymore, Christian. And it's almost like Paul doesn't have the language sort of strong enough to express how he feels. Look at verse 3. These things, they mustn't even be named among you. Don't even talk about this stuff, Christians. Why not even talk about them? If we talk about them, then they're in our heads. If they're in our heads, then maybe, I guess Paul might be reasoning, we'll end up doing them. It's like Paul is saying, flee, shut them out. Don't even let this idea cross your lips. Verse 4 continues, no filthiness, Again, a direct reference to language of a sexual nature. No foolish talk, could be just translated silly talk. No crude jokes. Anything with a suggestive overtone. It's sort of the double entendre, that sort of thing. Why? Why not these things? Why again list all this stuff? Well, they are audible proof of a dirty mind. You sometimes hear little children go on about this sort of stuff, don't you? What you say is what you are. The taunts of the playground, if the child doesn't want to respond back, they just say, what you say is what you are. And that's the point that Paul is making. The way we talk reveals who we are. These actions, these words, they flow from a life which has me at the heart of it. But you see, the Christian recognizes that life is not first and foremost about me, not first and foremost about my wants, my desires. Life is about God, about his plan. And that's why the alternative to all of this comes in verse 4, thanksgiving. I was very interested by this alternative. Have a look, verse 4, let there be no filthiness, no foolish talk, no crude joking, which are out of place, but instead, let there be thanksgiving. That means I need to sort of positively fill my thinking, my words, my language, my life with thanksgiving, with facts about, with words about, as we'll go on and see later on, with songs about what God has done for me. And this isn't just sort of Debrett's for the Christian. This is the proper Christian life, radically different from the world. You see, the world ultimately is self-seeking, aiming to please self, wanting what it doesn't have, coveting. In contrast, the Christian lives by grace. God has done it all. Life is marked by thanksgiving, thanking God for what we do have. Not constantly looking for and desiring the things we don't have. We're going to try to apply this. As I said, we're going to be spending most of our time in these first couple of verses, so don't worry as the time ticks by. This is really the main thing that we need to grasp today, this radical Christian behavior. We're going to apply it into two areas, which I think are the two areas highlighted here. Firstly, practice, and secondly, language. We'll start in the deep end with practice. Verse 3, sexual immorality, all impurity or covetousness. As we said, it's the deep desire to have what we don't have. In this, with all this sort of sexual language going on, essentially it's the desire to have somebody else's body for my own gain, for my own satisfaction. Mostly we're thinking about sex and sexual desire, not exclusively. Here are a few examples of what we're talking about. This is the Christian couple going out for a few months. Things started off very well. They'd hold hands. But one evening, things just went too far. This is the single woman who thinks the only way she can get what she wants in a relationship is to compromise on some of God's standards of sexual purity. This is the man in the office who spends his time fantasizing about a relationship with a colleague. This is the married woman who deeply desires a younger woman's body and increasingly feels discontent with what she has. This is the married man who wants to be respected in the world for the way his wife looks, increasingly encourages her to dress to impress the world. This is the Christian who finds themselves increasingly in the grip of pornography. Probably a man, although one of the surveys my attention was drawn to talked about women becoming increasingly addicted as well. As I mentioned, the language, the original Greek word here is porneia. It is, of course, where this word comes from, pornography. Let me read something here from the rather entertainingly named Klein Snodgrass, very good commentator. He addresses this issue. But what is wrong with pornography viewed in the privacy of one's own home? Besides demeaning people by viewing them as sex objects, pornography destroys by staying in the mind. It structures the brain in an illegitimate way. This is not just appreciation of beauty, but the feeding and embracing of lust. It gears the mind in the direction of inappropriate acts. It is both the first step to sexual sin and is sin itself. As Jesus pointed out strongly, What you do with your mind matters, especially with regard to sexual sin. Furthermore, he concludes, pornography is a devious monster that entraps men especially and becomes an addiction. And all of these examples, it would be easy to go on and on and on. You can see how applications could mount up very quickly. Simple point, it is totally out of place in the Christian life. And it's not just a case of slamming a door on it. It's not just a case of taking practical steps to avoid it, although that's the right start. It's a matter of positively filling our lives, our minds, with thanksgiving for what God has done. And the more I thought about this, the more I realized that thanksgiving and filling our minds with thanksgiving and our words, our language with thanksgiving, it's not just the alternative activity. It's also the antidote to a lot of this. So if you're a Christian and you're suddenly overcome by desire for something, for someone, don't let your mind run away in fantasy. Instead, remind yourself at that moment, or just before you feel that moment coming on, remind yourself of everything that God has done for you. It has all sorts of very practical applications. I mean, if you're the sort of person that is prone to letting your eyes wander over the top shelf of the newsagent, then just before that happens, remind yourself. Take steps actively to remind yourself of what God has already done for you. You have every spiritual blessing already. Remember, Christian, your behavior really matters. Another application, first sort of main area of our practice. Let's think secondly about our language. You see, the warnings of verse 4 are nearly all connected with the language that we use. Sometimes us Christians, we like to be a bit edgy in our conversation, don't we? We like to try and show that we're streetwise, that we're with it. We're not sort of trapped in some Victorian Stone Age. We are instead part of this world. But Paul says, no sexual chatter, no crude jokes, not even any foolish, the word could just be translated silly, talk. Not saying don't be funny, but there are some types of humour that are completely out of place. You see, the speech that we use amongst ourselves and in the world is going to have a profound impact. Remember, what you say is what you are. And sexually obsessed chatter, foolish talk, crude jokes, well, they reveal what's going on inside us. They show us to be, well, exactly like the world. The more I thought about this, so much is about mindset, so much is about having the right sort of stuff going on inside our heads. And so I think we've got to think carefully about what we spend our time filling our minds with. It may be an incredibly obvious thing to say, but I guess the more we fill our minds with the sexually obsessed chatter, to use the three sort of things here in verse 4, the foolish talk, the crude jokes, the more we fill our minds with this, then the more we're going to think about them, the more we're going to laugh at them, the more they just become part of our life. If you think about verse 4, I mean, it's the language of the sort of Friday or Saturday night chat show, isn't it? I mean, this is Graham Norton. This is Jonathan Ross. This is most TV, I guess. Fill our minds with these things and we become used to them. We join in with them. And so I guess you're thinking now, is this guy preaching? Is he actually saying we can't watch the chat shows on Friday and Saturday night? I'm not saying that, okay? Don't misrepresent what I'm saying. Remember, we are saved by grace. All the way through this, we are saved by grace. And grace never leads to legalism. It leads to freedom. Freedom, in this case, freedom to behave properly. Be the people that God has made you to be. That's the challenge for us today. And don't underestimate the effect of some of these things on your minds. You see, when we hear verse 4 language, it should shock us. It's completely out of step with the person that God has made us. And so if this sort of language, all the sort of stuff listed in verse 4, if it's something that you sort of think, actually, you're pretty used to it now, it makes you laugh quite a lot, something that you're pretty desensitized to, maybe that's a warning sign. It's really hard because I realize that the verse 4 language, I mean, it describes your office. It describes your classroom. It is your hall of residence. It's all very well saying, let there be thanksgiving instead. As I was talking to one friend about this last week, he said, what am I meant to do? Pull out my tambourine? You see, it doesn't always mean the Christian has to sort of come charging in with a gospel presentation. What it means is that the language we use, it really matters. God has decided that the world around us will find out about him, will understand his glory and his grace through us, through the church. And if the church looks like the world, if the church sounds like the world, well, then it's just not going to notice. And this is really serious. Look at verse 5 and 6. Verse 5 and 6 spell out just how serious this is. For you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure or who is covetous, that is an idolater, has, look at this first warning, no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ. Live in a fantasy world, die in a fantasy world. Verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, second warning, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. You see, the office culture, it may praise and adore the crude joke. The world around may say that something is okay. It may even make a certain practice legal. But these are empty words, empty promises. Why empty? Because they lead to destruction. The empty words, the fantasy world. If you live by empty words, you will die by empty words. Proper Christian behavior does not accommodate this stuff. This isn't the worthy life that God has freed us for. This is not what God has saved you for. And so Paul ends this section, verse 7. Don't associate with them. It's interesting, isn't it? Therefore, do not associate with them. It doesn't mean don't mix with the world. It means don't share their practices. I think that's what the them refers to there. The standards, you see, are radically out of step with the world. The bar is high. It's impossibly high. As we're saying at this point, that doesn't mean that Christians will never make mistakes. Of course, Christians will make mistakes. We will often fall down in this area. We will often look just like the world. And sometimes we will come across people who aren't Christians, but because of their very sort of strict code of practice, their high moral standards, they will live in a way which actually looks much better than a lot of Christians. A Christian will mess up. We will fall. But the difference will be we care. And we are battling prayerfully with the help of fellow Christians to live properly. Back to our main idea. When we fall on our face, we know that we don't just upset our own standards. We don't just let ourselves down. We go against God. We go against his plan for the world. When we mess up, we say sorry. And we're confident because of his grace that God will forgive us. So if you're feeling completely sort of at a loss at this stage, thinking I've really blundered in one of these areas, then come back to the cross. Come back to the God of grace who saved you. There's nothing you did to be saved in the first place. Come back to the death of Jesus. And just as we close, we'll consider much more briefly. You see, proper Christian living, it really matters. It produces fruit. Verses 8 to 14. For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. And try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. There's a lovely sort of mixture of metaphors in this passage. Christians are labeled as, in verse 8, children of light, people who must therefore walk as the people that God has made us. Same sort of idea from the first half. No longer darkness, but light. Now, it's not saying that a Christian's surroundings, when they become a Christian, suddenly sort of get lit up. Not saying that suddenly their path will become clear. Rather that we become light. We were darkness, now the opposite extreme, light. Think of those sort of incredibly bright torches, the sort of thing that the kids always have on camp, sort of shine in your eyes when you're not sort of paying full attention. Or think the sort of the alternative image, the blackout cloth, the sort of thing you might put up in a child's bedroom to block out the light. Paul's point, know who you are, Christian. You can't go around covering everything up, just trying to blend in. But look at verse 8. You see, the only reason that we're light is because we are in the Lord. Our identity, our ability to shine is only because of who God has made us. It's only because we've been sort of geographically located in Christ as a result of his death. Interestingly, as light, we produce fruit. All the good and true conduct, all the proper behavior is the fruit. And leads to fruit. We have to behave in a way that is fitting, in a way that is appropriate. Verse 10, we need to work out what pleases the Lord, be the light that you are. Again, not the great big sort of cover-up. But that's not the end. Look at what happens. This was a surprise to me, again, as I was reading this. See, the fruit is not just our behavior. Verse 11, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. What should the Christian expose? Well, when I first read it, I thought it meant the people, but the them in verse 11, again, it refers not to the people, but instead to the unfruitful works. You see, the unfruitful works of the world are exposed, not as we go around sort of obnoxiously naming and shaming. It's the sort of RML weekend, isn't it, where people promise to name and shame the people that haven't paid up. This is not what's going on here. Instead, by our distinct life, by our proper behavior, the world's works are shown up for what they are. Our proper behaviors, he stands as a notable contrast with the world's. And Paul says, this produces fruit. Verse 13, when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible, for anything that becomes visible is light. You see the progression, having been exposed, becomes visible, turns into light, the final step. It's the process of having deeds shown up for what they are actually leads the person to becoming light themselves. It's an interesting situation. The Christian leads a radically different life. And this life will convict some occasionally of their out of step with reality life. And it will, in some cases, lead to their conversion. I say, of course, lead to their conversion because we must bear in mind what Paul has taught very clearly through this letter. Do you remember, just glance back to 1:13, you remember how it was that the Ephesians were converted? They weren't converted just because they saw people behaving well. They were converted, verse 13, chapter 1, in him you also, when you heard the word of truth, the gospel of your salvation, and believed. You see, hearing the words of Jesus, hearing the gospel, is fundamental to becoming light. Nevertheless, this section was written, as we said at the beginning, to show us that the way the Christian lives their lives really matters. So much so that here Paul seems to be saying that it will be the quality of our life, our proper behavior, that will be the final step needed for someone to become a Christian. And that's why the section ends with this wonderful little quote, "Awake, O sleeper, arise from the dead, Christ will shine on you." It's not an exact quote, but it's very similar language to a place in Isaiah where the nations are described as flocking to Israel because she becomes a bright light. And so here is the point again, the one simple point that we've had all the way through. Proper Christian behavior matters. You see, it makes our witness to the world light up like a Christmas tree. The gospel is adorned. The gospel is shown in all its true glory as the church behaves in the way that God intends it, intends us to behave. The world will notice, the world will be attracted, and the world will come to know the God who has made it. Those asleep will wake up, the dead will rise. Because ultimately, the same light which transformed our darkness is instrumental in transforming the world around us too. So be under no doubt, behavior matters, says Paul. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, help us to think carefully over these words. Help us to be people that walk by grace. And may that grace work itself out in proper, appropriate behavior. May that behavior adorn the gospel, and may many in this world be attracted to the bright light which is the church, standing in stark contrast to the world around. In Jesus' name, amen.